Hi, everyone. Thanks for sticking it out to the end. This is, the last session and the last talk at last session in APHA, so thanks for sticking it out and not going to the parade. So I'm Steve Cohen. I'm faculty at Virginia Commonwealth University. I want to start off by saying that a lot of what you'll hear in my talk will echo what has been in the previous three talks about caregiving and certain aspects of it that are important as we move forward. I want to take a moment and acknowledge my our wonderful grad student Monique Brown, who's in the room, who's working on related information that's coming out soon, some related research. So thanks for your help. The most important slide, I have nothing strange to disclose. I'm sure I'm preaching to the choir because most of you know this, but what is informal caregiving? How do you define it? It's generally unpaid care given by family, most often family, friends, relatives, neighbors, generally to older adults, and some of the most common conditions that require necessitate informal care is Alzheimer's and dementia. It's one of the big ones. There's other forms as well, post-cancer, post-fall, things like that. Typically, these caregivers aren't trained in caregiving, and they're usually unpaid. There are a couple exceptions where you can get paid care by your family members, but those are generally pretty rare. And one of the key things about it is that the care recipient is usually living at home, so they're not institutionalized, they're not taking up, it's a different environment. It's one that doesn't require, formal care. Why is this important? Well, there are about 50 million informal caregivers in the United States, which is almost 20% of the population. And that was an older estimate. So I'm sure that number is increasing. Now, I should say, of course, that not everybody is providing round-the-clock care to their older relatives or to their spouses. I mean, that would be sort of impossible to do for 50 million people. But this is 50 million represents the people that provide some caregiving services. And there was an estimate put out in 1999 that said that this informal caregiving saves the national economy $200 billion per year, which is actually surpasses the amount of money spent on formal care, which is home health aides and nurses and all that other stuff, and institutionalization, which is pretty shocking, I think. And most of that care is provided by relatives, and a lot of those relatives are typically children, and I dare say they're usually daughters, a lot of them are part of the sandwich generation, which I know some of my colleagues had spoken about earlier, that they have caregiving responsibilities to their older relative, their parent, and they have caregiving responsibilities to their children, often whether it be young children or teenagers. And before I launch into the whole public health crisis type of thing, I'm going to say that there are benefits to both the caregiver and the care recipient. I mean, there are known benefits to society, but there are also benefits to the caregiver as well. And there's a lot of life satisfaction. I won't go into a lot of the detail about that, but I'd be happy to share with you some studies that have shown that there are benefits. Now to the bad side. So there are a lot of consequences. There's a number of health effects, both physical and mental. There are other things that are related to health, such as couple health. It strains marital relationships. It strains employment. There's also a maldistribution of time and resource allocation. There's also families. There's often an imbalance, even among children of elderly parents. There's often an imbalance in the amount and the intensity of caregiving that's given. And there's also been shown a reduction in preventive health behaviors, so things like eating healthy, exercise, and other things. So there's sort of a whole host of things that go on with informal caregiving. To further worry everybody, of course, as we know, the population is aging. Again, I know I'm preaching to the choir, but the number of 65-year-olds and above is going to more than double in the next 20 years. And in particular, the people that tend to need the most care, are the 85 and above population, will grow, will almost quadruple in the next 40 years from 5.5 million now to about 19 million. So this need is going to increase. The whole population structure is going to change, and we need to do something about it. And the other thing, too, is not only is the population it's going to increase, but there's spatial variation in terms of where the elderly live. And those associations that we find between caregiving and health do tend to vary by certain demographic factors that have been shown. here's the map that we my old mentor in grad school told me that to look for to the kind of the center of the country, which I can't quite pull up, but she referred to that as the elderly belt. It's probably a little offensive, but so there's the older population is not distributed evenly in the United States. They're in tend to be in, of course, we know Florida, the center of the country, the Southwest, and interestingly, in a lot of Appalachia as well. And they don't tend to be in a lot of the urban areas. And last year, if you suffered through my talk, I had talked a little bit about how these variations, these associations between caregiving and health, are modified by rurality. I looked at a couple different outcomes, and I'll just show you just a couple quick highlight. One was self-reported health. 5 is worst. 1 is the best. I divided up by rural, intermediate, and urban counties, and found that on the top is the self-reported health, and the bottom is exercise status. So actually, you want people to exercise more. It's have you ever exercised in the last 30 days? And we found that the association between caregiving and health was worse in the urban areas, which completely contradicted my hypothesis, was strongest in the urban areas, and also the association, the positive association, or the good association between exercise status and health in caregivers was actually strongest in the intermediate areas and weakest in the urban areas. So it's kind of showing that actually in urban areas it may be more the effect of caregiving is actually more severe than in other areas, which shocked me. So maybe it's not that shocking. But today, what I'm going to look at is, I'm going to tell you a little bit about, is about how those associations between caregiving and health, health status in particular, vary by income and employment status. Now, we know that income and employment status have a relationship between whether or not someone's able to provide care. But now we're going to kind of break those up. I'll just kind of briefly go over the data and the methods, and then jump into the results. We used the BRFIS, 2009 BRFIS data. We used it from all 50 states and D.C. We had a large sample size, which is nice and kind of strange. We looked at three different. So the primary exposure, I should point out, is caregiving, yes or no, caregiving to someone who requires it. And there is a little problem with that because a few of them we suspect are caregiving to children or people or non-elderly adults. We looked at three selected outcomes. I'm only going to talk really about one today, but I'd be happy to share with you some information that we have on the other ones. What we did is the main analysis, and there's a lot of mumbo-jumbo here, but basically what we did is logistic regression. There's a lot more to it, but that's what it boils down to, and the results are going to be logistic regression. And we assessed effect modification in two ways. One was through stratification, so you can kind of see the results visually, and one was interaction terms to determine whether or not, if there it was an interaction, whether or not it was statistically significant. So I'm going to jump right into it. So first, looking at income. Don't be alarmed too much. There's a lot of data on here, but so I'll just walk you through this first one, and then you'll be oriented. So we looked at 4 different models. One is the unadjusted model, which is model 1. That's just the effect of caregiving. So caregiving predicts poor health. We know that it's a very small effect, but because the sample size is ginormous, statistically significant. The next model, model 2, is sort of what I would call the personal demographic model, which includes a lot of other health, some health things like BMI, also includes gender and race and ethnicity, things like that. The third model is just like model 2, but it's been adjusted for demographics, including area level demographics, which is that rural intermediate, and income category. And then the last model is the same as model 3, except it shows the interaction terms. So that's really where you should be direct your attention here. And we notice, but there's actually a couple things going on here. Is one, just looking at income alone, the effect of income, of course, itself is actually a very strong predictor of poor health. And this is looking at self-reported health that's, I should point out, that's either very good or excellent versus poor, fair, or good. So that's where the split was. And as income gets higher, the effect diminishes. But looking at the interactions between caregiving and health, caregiving and income on health, we actually find that in the low-income categories, caregiving is actually protective. So there's actually a negative interaction, saying that caregiving actually potentially mitigates the association between income and health, or vice versa, that income mitigates the association between caregiving and health. And it's noticed that it's the weakest when in the higher income categories, and the reference category is 75,000 and plus and above. So now we're going to shift the outcome a little bit. We're looking at poor to very good. So there's four different categories versus excellent health. So this is the predicting poor to very good health, and we find very similar results. A little bit the impact, the actual magnitude is a little bit lower, but we find pretty similar results. A nice almost linear relationship as income increases. And we find here that there is, once again, in the lowest income category, there is a negative interaction, a significant negative interaction. In the highest two, there's no significant interaction. And we also looked at, we also looked at the number of days of poor health. So this is using a Poisson model and modeling the number of days of poor health. So once again, higher is bad, so higher is worse. Meaning that there's an association. So not surprisingly, on the we find that the interactions again are the caregiving and income is actually somewhat protective. But if you look at the actual income categories, once again we find that the associations decrease as income increases. So a couple of strange things. And then to kind of look at this using stratification, so we're looking at the top two, we're looking at the odds ratios, predicting poor to only poor to good health, and then poor to very good health. And the bottom one is the relative risk of increasing number of days of poor health. We find that in the income categories are on the x-axis, and we find that the association is strongest in it almost goes up, not quite linearly, but certainly monotonically, as we go as we increase income categories, meaning that the effect of caregiving is strongest in the higher income categories compared to the lowest income categories. And it wasn't quite the same for the number of days of poor health, and I'm not quite sure why that is. But in anyone that wasn't the lowest category, the association between caregiving and health was statistically significant. So let's look a little bit at employment. And employment was very strange in the behavioral risk factor surveillance system. So I tried my best to categorize it in a way that was done in the past, and try to use the categories that were there. So there's actually three different levels of employment. The reference group is not employed, and I'm not saying unemployed because some of them are also retired. And the two other categories, one big category is homemaker, and then the other big category was employed for wages. This is interestingly in 2009 when the economy was at its worst. So once again, same sort of model layout. We find that the association between employed for wages and health was actually very strongly negative, which of course it makes sense because healthier people are able to work. Makes sense. But once again, we find that the interactions between caregiving and employment are oddly negative. So the interactions are negative, meaning that they're actually mitigating the impact of caregiving on health. The same thing, so this is the second outcome, which is looking at poor to very good health versus excellent health. We find very similar results. Here's the stratified models, looking at overall employed homemaker and non-employed, and we find that the associations between caregiving and health are strongest for the employed, and they're actually for the not employed, the association between caregiving and health is actually statistically significantly negative, meaning that caregiving actually is a predictor of better health. I have suspicions. We'll go on a little bit more. And the same thing for the other, the very good health. And you notice that the confidence intervals are wide for homemaker because it was a slightly smaller category. So now let's take a look at employment and income together. We're going to break it down by employment category and income category, sort of a 2x2, or actually a 3x4 table. And this is just looking at the effect of caregiving on the poor to good health. So this is just looking at that one, the caregiving variable, looking at the 12 different strata. And we find that in the employed for wages category, every single category, this pink, which doesn't really show up too well here, but the pink shows that they're all statistically significantly positive, meaning that in those categories, caregiving is positively associated with poor health. And interestingly, in the lowest income category, in the non-employed category, they're actually the opposite. So it's actually negatively associated, meaning that in that category, caregiving is actually a predictor of better health. And the same thing, very similar results when we change the outcome to poor to very good. And I won't belabor this. So sort of to kind of sum up a little bit, I know I'm getting close to time, is the relationship, this relationship between caregiving and health really depends on these socioeconomic factors. And so these one-size-fits-all kind of caregiving support models may not work in every, we found it last year in every location in terms of rurality or in urbanicity, and we're finding it now with in terms of it getting at the different income and employment groups. So sort of target those individual, target the programs and policies based on individual sort of the socio-demographic characteristics. And the biggest mystery that I found is why is caregiving associated with better health in the lowest income and unemployed groups, and which is perplexing. I know a couple random theories that I had, you know, was maybe there's a sense of purpose, maybe it gives them a reason to get up, and maybe there's also an idea of the selection of healthy caregivers in the sample, which could be another possibility. But I'm happy, I would be really curious to know what you think as well. And so there's lots of limitations, the large sample, meaning that you notice that in a lot of cases the effect of caregiving or one of the variables was small but statistically significant, so maybe not that clinically meaningful, but it's certainly meaningful in terms, certainly statistically significant. There's not a lot of detail on caregiving intensity, that's sort of the next step, because there's a caregiving module that has a lot more detail. And there's income category cutoffs are arbitrary. I don't know why Burfus chose the ones that they did, but they did, and that's what we have to work with. And there's also, we would like to break it down a little bit by the specific type of caregiving relationship, whether it was spouse or child, parent. But I want to really get to the future research, which maybe you're interested in this, maybe you're not, but there's a new data set that's coming out this fall that's from the NHATS, the National Health and Aging Trends Survey, that's the first national data set looking at caregiving. If it's not out already, I haven't checked in the last week since I've been here, but if it's not out already, it's supposed to be coming out in November, So it has 100 different questions on caregiving activities, and it's a nationally representative sample. And from my perspective, it's pretty cool. So these are some references, and I just want to thank you very much. If you have my contact information here, and I guess we're going to take questions for everybody. So if you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them. I don't know how you.
I'm not sure if you're familiar with a study by Becker at all, creating continuity through mutual assistance, intergenerational reciprocity in four ethnic groups. But because we tend to focus a lot on the negative, on the barriers and the strain for caregivers and caregiving, and also with the elderly, we turn them into a passive non-actor as recipient of care. But in that study, and I'm glad that you focused on some of the positive in terms of what you can gain from that caregiving or in that sandwich generation for the elderly in particular. And she talks about how intergenerational reciprocity for the elderly to take you know, assume certain grandparental roles, great-grandparental roles, mm-hmm. or do something, you know, participate in that as an agent, as an active agent. And role continuance is critical for them to negotiate in that caregiving relationship to, while accepting informal or formal care in order to enhance their quality of life. So I'm glad that you're also focusing on all that positive to be gained from that relationship.
Okay, there are a lot of positive things. These are often overlooked in this literature, vastly the negatives, but there are those positives.
So I have a question for you. Did you actually use the social support survey in the data that you collected? Were you collecting?
Right. No, I was asked by clinicians. I was a researcher in the Department of Family Medicine at the time, and the clinician said, "Well, you know, we're providing all the services for Puerto Rican elderly. Let's see what can we learn about their caregiving with a small pilot, and see, you know, what difficulties they're having, what kind of support they're getting in order to perhaps improve their care." So I use the idea of see, you know, whether they can take care of instrumental activities of the individual, but then I developed my own questionnaire to obtain some information related to health and social support. I did use the SF-12 to obtain some quality of life, but no, I did not use that.
I have a question on patient navigator.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell
providers into the job, into the agency, into the do private care, and they're much like what I sense in your project, where they don't feel like they could quite do CNA work, but if we had a step like this where they could build their confidence, then they could feed into all of your projects, and then they could decide, because some of them are older, but they do so much in the home care, as I'm sure we And if we could get that across the nation, you know, then it could really be at the standard with patient navigators, and not just with cancer, but with everything. I mean, I'm a whole health nurse. There's so many things we should be doing. Your studies were fabulous. Thank you.
I really enjoyed this. I think it's a trend toward that home care worker, which, you know, a very entry level job, but basically looking at training requirements. There's a national look at training requirements, and that's kind of the first step of the professional relationship. Mm-hmm. You know, set the competencies, require the training, get the training. But then there's the whole issue of pay and you know, making it a job that isn't popular.
Exactly. And there is a closing ceremony at 2:30.
Yes.
In fact, so, with some fabulous speakers, so we shouldn't forget.
Thank you, everyone.